KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Degrees and mostly cloudy in Seattle.
This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. I'm Steve Scheer. Thanks for joining us. The state legislative session in Olympia drawing to a close. Today is day 92 of the expected 105-day session. Will there be a special session, or will the legislators finish their work, get a budget, and go home? Jerry Kornfield is a reporter, political columnist for the Everett Herald. He's been guiding us through this legislative session, this session. Jerry, good to talk to you again.
Good morning. You said the dreaded words for those of us, special session.
Well, you still have, you got 10, 13 days? What do you think?
Yeah, a whole 13 days to, settle about a $2.5 billion difference between the House and the Senate. Yeah, it's tough. It is, and they are starting to get close to that we can't make it deadline, but there's still time. So we'll hope they can do it.
Is everybody's budget now out and ready for review by the other parties?
Yes, they're all out. The House has passed its budget. The Senate has passed its budget. The House did theirs on Friday. But there's still a couple missing pieces, and to the extent that the conversation can get serious about negotiations, the one missing piece is the House has yet to pass any legislation to raise revenue. You know, they proposed $1.3 billion in tax revenue from extending a couple taxes that were supposed to go away, closing a bunch of tax loopholes, and they haven't introduced a bill that says exactly what they want to do and how they want to do it. And until they do that, the Senate might just sit back and wait. The strategy is, the House, you want to raise money? Well, you pass the bill to raise the money. And so they may just sort of sit back there, and what was the movie? They show us the money, House. Make sure you can pass it.
Why would they? Why would the House be holding back on passing this part of their budget?
Well, some strategies are. It's the strategies over the last few years have been the House picks an amount of money they want to spend, a total amount, and the Senate picks an amount of money they want to spend, and they work out their differences. And when they get to a number of here's how much the next budget will spend, then they go about figuring out how to get there. So I think the House may be saying, we don't need to raise $1.3 billion in taxes. Maybe we only need to raise, $1 billion or $500 million or some smaller number. So they may be holding back, figuring, hey, if we can agree on a smaller budget and less revenue, then maybe we can agree quickly on how we get to that revenue.
So then we have some areas of agreement here, right, between the House and the Senate?
Right. I mean, there's a few big areas of agreement. When the year started, if anyone had thought the House and Senate were going to agree on expanding Medicaid, you might have been in a minority. But in fact, both budgets assume full expansion of Medicaid, which means 250,000 more adults will become eligible for some health care. And the federal government has said, we're going to pick up the tab for everybody. So at least for the next couple of years. So, this will save the state money, and both parties and both chambers have agreed to do this. So that's one of the really big areas. They've also agreed to do something where teachers aren't happy, but it's suspend cost of living increases. The voters said a few years ago, Initiative 732, give teachers a COLA. Well, they once again are suspending it and saving that $320 million and helping solve their budget problems with it.
They also are both agreeing to, $126 million for fewer people seeking services through TANF and Working Connections, these child care programs, and became welfare.
Yeah, what that is, and it's one of these numbers, if you're drawing up a budget, you anticipate how many people are going to come forward and use these services. They set a figure, a caseload figure, and then they assign amount of money to that. So they expected around 32,000 people in this current budget to come forward and use those services. The number was far less. They're now predicting as a result that the number won't be that much going forward. So the savings they're booking, it's really basically fewer people are expected to come in because they've had fewer people come in the past.
So on this budget deal overall, it sounds like is it all happening behind the scenes? Are they trying to find Republican support for getting rid of the tax breaks in the Senate?
It's happening on sort of two levels. You have your budget writers, and they're sitting around saying, look, in the House, we want to spend $34.5 billion in the next budget, and the Senate is saying, no, we want to spend $33.2 billion. So there's a group of folks trying to argue over those numbers and find a middle number. Meanwhile, you have the tax people in the House are trying to write a bill saying, okay, well, here's all the pieces, and they're negotiating, I think, amongst themselves, amongst the House Democratic Caucus, to say, are we really going to go forward, for example, and make a permanent tax on beer? Are we going to permanently increase the tax per barrel of beer? And we're going to also start charging the microbrewers? There's opposition within the House Democratic Caucus, so they're kind of negotiating with themselves on some of the pieces of that revenue package.
Trey Cornfield is with us. Also, they have to come up with a transportation budget. There's opposition to the Columbia River crossing. Also, they're afraid they'll lose federal money if they don't come up with a redesign that has the components that everybody at the federal level wants to see in there. This is a fight that's going to continue.
Yeah, it's an interesting and somewhat perplexing fight. The transportation budgets in the Senate and the House, when they were rolled out by their respective authors, they both used the word bare bones to describe them. So the budgets themselves have no money for new projects. They're basically, every dollar we're getting in, we're going to just spend it on what we've been spending, and nothing really new. The real big project, the Columbia River crossing, the new bridge over the Columbia River, is going to have to be paid for out of a revenue package either the voters are going to get or the lawmakers will pass, probably from a gas tax hike. And that's the sticking point. Opponents to that project are holding up everything related to transportation. They want that project, as you mentioned. They want it redesigned. Senator Don Benton out of Vancouver says, you designed it too low. We can't get some ships through. And by the way, we don't want light rail on it. And that's the real hang up with the federal government. The federal government will give a bunch of money, close to $1 billion or more, they say, as long as there's light rail going down the middle of the bridge. And opponents of light rail say, you keep your money, we don't want light rail. And so you do have this political fight, and I'm not sure how that's going to play out, because you have to put some money in for the federal government to give you any money back.
Now, the House and the Senate have to act by Wednesday on a deadline to pass bills that came from the opposite chamber. Does that mean that some of the controversial bills are still alive because at least one chamber passed them and may move forward?
Well, yes and no. I mean, this is where you get to some bills are more dead than others. These are all non-budget policy bills, and the really controversial ones are somehow going to be tied to the budget. Education reform bills that are probably not going to be, they may be passed by each side, but they're so different in the House from the Senate that you'll have to negotiate them out. The DREAM Act, which dealt with financial aid for foreign-born children whose parents came here illegally, they're going to possibly debate that as part of the budget because the House still has it. But for the most part, between now and Wednesday, what you're going to see are a lot of little tinkering with existing laws, some amending here, revising there, a couple of clauses added, a couple words taken away, those kind of policy bills between now and Wednesday.
Any surprises in that, or it will just be tinkering?
Well, it's hard to see if there'll be surprises. I think one of the things about the hundreds of bills that get introduced, they generally have some person or organization who came to a lawmaker and said, hey, we need to change the law because of this problem. So, tow truck drivers and the prices that are charged in Seattle for tow trucks, that's going to change. Is it going to be as good as people want? Probably not, but that bill is moving along, and that'll come to a conclusion. There'll be a registry created for firearm offenders. That bill needs to pass still in the Senate, but it will, if you're convicted of a firearm offense, you will be having to register most likely. So bills like that, they're sort of non-controversial, but they're important. They will be passing.
The DREAM Act is still alive.
Yeah, it's barely alive. It's the House Democrats decided to write up a budget and pass a budget that has $100,000 to implement the DREAM Act. Now, the Senate hasn't voted on it, but by doing that, the House has sort of thrown the DREAM Act into the budget negotiations. So they're saying, you know, if you guys really don't want it, then you're going to have to probably negotiate and give up something in your budget for us to take this away. That's what happens. You get a lot of these sort of negotiating chips at this stage.
Well, that'll be interesting to see what they're going to, what the chips will be that they throw down for.
Well, you know, both House and Senate have increased the amount of funding for state financial aid, and there appears to be a majority, and maybe even a large majority, in the Senate that supports the concept of the DREAM Act, which just extends eligibility. It doesn't give anybody money. It just makes more people eligible. The problem is the woman who is the chair of the Senate Higher Education Committee doesn't agree with it, so therefore she kept the bill bottled up. Now that it's in negotiations, she may, and others like her, may have to buy into the final negotiated agreement, and they may just have to live with that one.
All right. And then finally, aerospace funding. It sounds like the House and the Senate are sending mixed messages, as you write, on the issue of aerospace funding, but they are sending a message.
Yeah, I mean, we've been watching in Snohomish County because it's so big, and Everett is such a big employer of aerospace workers. When Boeing announced last week it was going to drop about $1 billion into South Carolina and hire a few thousand workers, we looked and said, okay, well, what's the state legislature in 2013 doing? And we found this kind of mixed message where we have a office of aerospace in the governor's office. The cabinet member is sort of this aerospace director. But the Senate says that we don't need that position anymore. We're not going to fund it. And the House is going to fund it. So that kind of difference of opinion has to be ironed out. And, you know, companies like Boeing, they do look at those little actions as, well, is Washington serious about keeping us forever or not? Are they serious about their aerospace industry or not? And I think those are the, you know, that'll be sort of a symbolic $200,000 expenditure. Keep the aerospace director in office or not.
All right, Jerry. We'll talk again. We'll see if you're going home or not, or you're going to be just entrenched in Olympia for months on end.
Yeah, we're going to see if next week will be the final week. Is that what you're saying? Oh, I hope so.
We'll see. I appreciate you talking to us.
All right. Talk to you later.
Jerry Kornfield is a reporter and columnist covering the state legislature for the Everett Herald. This is Weekday.
It's 9:17. Some thoughts on multiracial identity in modern America in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
45 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy. Forecast says it's going to wind up partly sunny this afternoon with a high today of 56. 918, I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 1897. You're stranded in the Antarctic. You've become a locavore by necessity. So what does that mean? Well, among other things, it means roast penguin, stories of desperation in the Antarctic in 20 minutes.
This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scheer. How we look at race in America continues to evolve, but we are in many ways still looking at race in the way we, all of us, have been looking at it for centuries. You know, when Stephen Colbert says, I don't see color, I don't see that at all, I'm blind to that. Yeah, he's probably joking. According to Relina Joseph, communication professor at the University of Washington, a multiracial African-American has many experiences, but two stand out. She is the author of Transcending Blackness, From the New Millennium Mulatta to the Exceptional Multiracial. Joins us in our studios. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
A very academic-sounding title and a very well-researched book, but personal as well and historical. Let's talk about history first. Because in this idea of mixed race, it seems like such an anachronistic phrase, mixed race, and yet permeates America's culture. from the very get-go.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it permeates the world's culture. Since there have been different migrations of people, there's been different mixtures of people. And certainly in the United States, there have been mixtures of people of Native descent, European descent, and African descent since first contact.
You know, when we think about the laws against miscegenation, oh man, look at me this morning, against people marrying outside their race.
Right.
What do you think in analyzing this was, at the basis of those laws in America between whites and blacks?
So there's a lot of controversy about this question that I think that what most people instinctively think is that the question is about fear of the other, right? So that there is a sense that we had to have anti-miscegenation laws protecting different groups of people, particularly protecting whites from contact with the other. But then there are other scholars that say that really this is about being able to maintain and create white privilege and power to control money that can go kind of exclusively to white people.
Because there was this other effort on the part of white slaveholders to increase their stock. Increase their what they could sell, right?
Absolutely. And if that stock was designated white instead of black, then the coffers were not being increased.
Didn't have the same value.
Exactly.
Monetary value.
Mm-hmm.
And so deliberate.
Yes.
Deliberate economic thinking involved in this at the basis of these laws. How about at the basis of the attitudes? One playing into the other?
Yeah, I think these things are always intertwined with another. The attitudes that came from science at the time, that came from religion, that came from popular culture, from plays, and from newspaper articles, from political texts, all of which led us to understand that white people were to be held above black people and to be separated in all kinds of ways. And that's essentially what I'm talking about in terms of it, the basis of understanding mixed race is to understand this, the desire for the separation.
Self-serving slaveholders, you quote one scholar
mm-hmm.
In their phrase, as a way to just do that, to maintain the power. Well, given that, when you write in the modern time
yeah.
about transcending blackness.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. You can make noises here. What does that mean to transcend blackness for an individual?
So I chose this phrase because I think that it's a really disturbing one. So the notion that blackness is something that needs to be transcended, that needs to be gotten over, that it is inevitably a lack, a slight, a mark, as opposed to a positive, wonderful entity. So this was at the heart of what I wanted to argue, came from the moments that you're talking about, the beginning of anti-miscegenation laws, all the way through our present moment. And the difference between that moment and today is that we understand mixed race through codes for the most part. So just as the ways that we talk about race when we talk about racism, although we've had some recent very clear explicit expressions of racial animosity, right? For example, against Latinos from local Republican lawmakers and against African Americans. For the most part, we see negative forms of racialization or negative stereotypes circulating in codes. And so that's something that I wanted to work on unpacking, particularly as they apply to multiracial African Americans or people who were identified as black and white.
What is President Obama?
Well, if you were to ask him, President Obama is black. He is African American.
Yeah. When President Obama came out after the Trayvon Martin killing,
right.
And he said, my kids would have looked like Trayvon Martin if they had been boys. Let's unpack all the things that were being said there.
Mm-hmm.
What was he saying about his identity?
So I mean, this is a really an interesting question. I think that he's identifying as Black, and in the way in which we've seen President Obama identify publicly, it has been as Black. He has also talked about his white family. He's also, famously referenced his mother from Kansas and his father from Kenya. But that has not precluded his identifying as African American. I think that in real life, that these identities are always together. They're very much a part of each other. They're fluidly understood. They're simultaneous. And yet, when we understand race, we think about them in these really separate binaristic manners.
Yeah.
So it makes sense to me that he identifies very much with Trayvon Martin's family, and also can talk about his white and Asian American family, for example.
Yeah, his half-sister was in town the other day from Indonesia. What does that tell us about how the president is perceived across this country by whites as well as Blacks?
Mm-hmm. I think that we, for the most part, we meaning all of us, see through the way in which we read our racialization. And for most people, that happens through phenotype. And I think that most people would be hard-pressed to racialize President Obama as anything other than of African descent.
Even though it lingers in our minds because he's talked about it, we see his mother, we see his grandparents.
Absolutely. And I think that, part of what I talk a little bit about in the book is that in the first election in particular, in order for him to become elected and to seem accessible, his campaign really attached us to his mixed race in order to make him seem the same and not different. And so rhetorically, we understand that he is this bridge to the rest of America, and the rest of America, of course, being the subtext being white America.
And yet he does not gather the majority of the white vote.
True.
He gathers the majority of the Black vote and the majority of other races vote. But he is a minority in terms of gathering the white vote.
And yet he was able to get more white vote than any other candidate of color for a presidential election in the past.
So do you think the president in his presentation tries to transcend his Blackness in the way that you talk about transcending being leaving it behind or denying it?
I think that this is a complicated question. When I'm talking about transcending Blackness, I'm talking about what happens in a representational sphere. So I'm not necessarily talking about personal intent or personal approaches to racialization. I'm talking about what do we see represented. And I think what we saw represented for him was an attempt to metaphorically see himself as connected to all of America, and to not explicitly name Blackness in very public spaces during the first election campaign. I think that also that switched in the way that those of us who are people of color understand that we switch our codes in various ways. And he certainly, in a very normal way, I think, not in the way that was kind of presented as pathological, but really normal way, switched codes with various audiences.
How do we switch codes as we go along?
Well, I think some people are allowed to be their whole selves in whatever room that they enter into.
White people.
Some white men.
Yes. Yes. Because this is not just about race alone, but this is where gender plays a role in race. In
yeah, absolutely. And class as well. And sexuality as well. That's what I'm looking at, all these things as they're understood as these connected entities. But there are other of us who are minoritized in various ways that might be through race or gender or sexuality, where we understand that in order to not be threatening, in order to not turn people off in various ways, that we have to connect with a mainstream voice. Sometimes that means very literally, sometimes that means in different elements of presentation. And I think that this is something that our president has had to negotiate as well.
So does that take us back to the subtext of all this, which is the continuing, if not racism, but also the racialization of our perceptions between each other? I mean, so by the way, you're saying Black Americans or even mixed race Americans have to adopt a bunch of codes in order to negotiate and navigate through a white world. Is that valid?
I think so. I think that, and it's not, again, I think that it's people who are not of the minority in terms of class, in terms of race, gender, sexuality.
So that was my question. You write about transcending blackness and gender. Do the same rules apply to mixed race Latinos or Asians in modern America?
So, you know, when I decided about what this book was going to be on, I drew on a bunch of research that looked at a variety of mixed race representations. And I felt like for me to make my strongest argument that I needed to focus on mixed race African Americans, not just because that was where my archive of information was, but because I still think the biggest sign of race in the United States is still blackness, is still African Americanness.
What do you mean by biggest sign of race? In terms of what's behind that statement, biggest sign of race?
I think that it goes towards our history of enslavement, that is something that we continue to work out on a daily basis and that we're dealing with the legacies of still. I think that in most people's mind, when we talk about race, what people's minds go towards is black and white. And understanding blackness and whiteness as being at the very kind of heart of how we think of the so-called race problem in this country, this still exists. And what I wanted to do in this book was to think about the election of President Obama that happened in 2008, but then what was the landscape of mixed-race African-American representations in the period leading up to it?
Relina Joseph is author of Transcending Blackness, From the New Millennium Mulatta to the Exceptional Multiracial. All right, just give me a quick sketch, because then I want to talk about something else. Sure, give me a quick sketch of the landscape that we see.
So what I see as I collected all of my texts and I thought about what were representations like in the movies, in television, through internet images, through novels and memoirs, what I saw is that there were these two controlling images. On one hand, we had that of what I'm calling the new millennium mulatta, the 21st century rollout of the old tragic mulatta character, who, despite understanding the tragedy, ends up performing that tragedy still. And then on the other hand, we had the exceptional multiracial figure, who is exceptional because of the way in which blackness is able to be metaphorically transcended, to be sloughed off, to be walked away from.
So that, abandoning part of their identity,
in a certain way, yes. And sometimes that works out to be kind of temporally. I think I'm talking about metaphors here. But what I saw was that in our world where we're not able to talk in explicit ways about race and racism, we're not able to talk about gender and misogyny, that race and these race and racism still happens through codes. Right. And so what I'm trying to do is name some of these codes that I see operating for mixed race blackness.
Because we're colorblind and we're post-racial.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Correct.
All right. Some of the codes. Let's start with the new millennium mulatta. What are some of the codes? Actually, let's talk about who we're talking about here. We're talking about all the way back to Uncle Tom's Cabin, mm-hmm. movies in the 30s, Birth of the Nation. In all these portrayals, the mixed race person is often portrayed as a little smarter than non-mixed African Americans, but more hypersexualized, more sensitive, and in the end, unstable. Is that
Absolutely.
Is that what we see?
Yes.
And why are we and why are we seeing it that way? What's the value culturally in portraying it that way?
Well, what I and other scholars who write about mixed race have talked about that the drops of white blood are what lead the character towards kind of greater intelligence, right? Greater mobility in culture in general, and that there's something about the mixing itself that creates this boiling of bloods, that creates this hypersexual persona. And again, we can see this in as early films like Birth of a Nation, for example, that the character of Lydia, who is this key character, is shown to be falling to the ground. Her shirt is falling off of her. She's tearing her clothes away. And she's also having an affair with a very powerful carpetbagger.
Yeah, we see it up into the 50s, the 30s and 50s. What was the name of that book that was remade? Was that
Imitation of Life?
Yeah, Imitation of Life. Yes. That's right. And then you write that we see it with Jennifer Beals in The L Word. The series The L Word. What's happening there?
Yeah, so the codes happen really differently there. So one of the chapters I focus on Jennifer Beals' character throughout the course of the television program The L Word, which is the cable show, the Showtime drama, and what I'm interested in with her is how over the course of these seasons we see her as being alone, isolated from the rest of the group, making very poor decisions at times, also being haughty and standing above many of the other characters. And to me, this resonated as part of the old character of the tragic mulatto, but in a very with a bunch of 21st century spins to them.
Would it have been different if there were many characters across a spectrum represented on TV?
I think this is true, yes, for all different types of minoritized groups, right? When you have a dearth of characters, you expect for them to perhaps fulfill all roles and to be quote-unquote positive, right? But when you have a multiplicity of roles, then you think, okay, we can have a wide variety of different people who are filling in various ways because they're not adding to a stereotype, right? They're just helping to flesh out humanity.
But do you see it? Do you see this? You see this tragic millennium mulatto continuing, showing up in TV, in movies, sort of books. The little head pops up all over the place.
I do see it continuing to pop up. I think that I have seen a marked shift, actually, since Obama's election. So this is the time period I look at, or representations from 1998 to 2008. And I think at that point, when I was collecting my texts, I saw that the new millennium mulatto was the more dominant stereotype of the two. And since Obama's election, I think we've seen the exceptional multiracial, or even before then, since he became kind of the viable Democratic candidate.
All right, so examples of exceptional multiracial, because again, this is about abandoning a part of a person's identity, yes?
Metaphorically,
yes. Why do you make that distinction?
Well, because I think that we're not thinking about the literal putting on of whiteface, for example. I think
some of your examples are.
Well, that's true. When I'm talking about America's Next Top Model, we're talking about the literal putting on of whiteface, right, on reality television. But how that signals a certain degree of success, being able to transform in that case into a white person from a mixed race African American person to become white, right, even within the space of one episode of a television show is shown to be a certain degree of success.
What is BOMBS? What was BOMBS? So I'm going to take it to the personal end because you write about it at the beginning.
Yeah. So I began college in 1992, and that was at the very beginnings of what became known as this multiracial movement. I went to Brown University, and there was this brand new student club called BOMBS, the Brown Organization of Multiracial and Biracial Students. And what this organization was concerned with was naming this kind of what felt like a new condition of mixed race, right? Of course, as we've been talking about, it wasn't new at all. But for those of us who were first-generation multiracial students whose parents had gotten together right after the Loving decision, just a number of years after the Loving decision that legalized interracial marriage, that we wanted to talk about our racialized identities and our experiences and how we had commonalities across different racial and ethnic groups. So how someone who was perhaps black and white would have a lot of interesting things in common with someone who might be Latino and Asian American, for example.
How do you feel about it today?
I think that having a space for mixed race kids or adults to be able to talk about their own processes of racialization is a really important thing. I think that where my growth, and I talk about this a bit in the book, has come is that what I also really want to do is to push people towards understanding multiracial processes of racialization alongside other forms of racialization and not an exclusion. And also to think about how what does it mean when we identify as multiracial?
What? Give me an example of those other processes. You said alongside and not as an exclusion. What do you mean by that?
So what I'm talking about is, for example, how do we connect our choices to identify as as Filipino and Black, right, for example, just to give an example, along with our understanding of the way in which race operates, right? So our choices to choose our own individual racial identity are also connected to how race operates, right? And so, for example, we recently had all of the coverage about a disproportional punishment that happened in the Seattle public school system for students, for Black and Native American students, right? That's about how race and power are operating together. And how someone chooses their own racial identity has to be seen as connected to that process. So choosing to identify as multiracial, if you are read as Black, right, and punished as Black in a school system, what's the significance then of identifying as multiracial outside of kind of for personal satisfaction?
Yeah. Well, how do you answer that?
I think that we have to understand race in really multiple ways. I think that we have to understand that, going back to your question about President Obama, that we have to understand that mixed race operates together with these what we would call monoracial definitions of race. So that someone can certainly have a father from Kenya and a mother from Kansas and still identify as African American and still also make comments about wanting to choose his dog, for example, because the dog is a mutt. And he was a mutt. This was before they chose Bo, when they were in the process of thinking about what type of dog they might want. That these things operate simultaneously.
Been following the Brad Paisley LL Cool J controversy?
Yes.
Controversy. The Accidental Racist song by Brad Paisley, where he talks about how he can't walk in another person's shoes. And you know, we're right here. And of course, LL Cool J being berated for his poor rhymes. What is that telling you about in the context of what you're writing about, that we are having this debate about the other,
right?
Aren't we?
And we're having a debate about the other that happens, I think, the assumption is that we're in a post-racial moment, right? And so we can just get over these old racial sentiments. Right, we can get over slavery. Essentially, what
don't
the song
be
is
don't
about.
Be giving me grief for wearing a Confederate flag. It's
right.
Just that I'm a white man from the South.
Right,
as if you're divorced from history,
and not understanding that history is operating in the present. Right, that's what the disproportionate sentencing is about, for example.
Yeah, so when you read that, or when you read that, mm-hmm. I mean, as an analyst, mm-hmm. what are you reading about where we actually are in terms of discussions about race today?
Well, I think that the song itself is interesting, but the response to me is even more interesting. And so the fact that we've had many commentators come out and say, well, actually, we're not at this post-racial moment. We need to talk about racism as not just being this accidental thing, but being intentional and lived in the present. And so to me, that's a really positive discussion, the fact that we're seeing that. And I have to say that since Obama's election, that we see more of these discussions. We certainly have the exceptional multiracial, kind of the desire to not talk about racialized difference and power and privilege. But we also have a number of dissenting voices that feel like, to me, have become more mainstream and heard more often.
Like which voices?
So, for example, in the cable news circuit, that we have more African American commentators. We have a I think that with Obama's coming to not even coming to the presidency, but just during that first election campaign, that there was a desire to have more people who could talk about race and culture, because of the way in which we understood our potential leader was going to bring in these large issues in a way never discussed before.
This is a much deeper question than just how you, I'm giving you time to answer it, I know, but you do touch on it. Just personally, mm-hmm. as your children get older, and you write about your children mm-hmm. being perceived differently depending on when the sun is shining.
Exactly, yeah.
What are you teaching them?
We teach them to talk about race. We teach them that just as we talk about our days, just as we talk about differences in gender, we talk about sexual orientation, we talk about class, we talk about race, and that there is not only is there nothing wrong in talking about race, it's something that we notice and so that we need to discuss with each other and as a family. And we talk a lot about commonalities. So I think that my partner, who is multiracial as well, that neither of us want to create a sense that they are unique or special in their own processes of racialization, that the way in which their race happens is very much the way in which other kids of other races and ethnicities race happens.
Does the process diffuse the real problems that you're writing about by talking about it?
It certainly helps to translate them. And I think that not only becoming a parent, writing, being an academic and a parent at the same time, but being a professor at a university where I get the opportunity to speak to hundreds of undergraduate students, that I have to talk about race in real life ways as well as in theoretical and historical ways.
Relina Joseph is associate professor in the Department of Communications at the UW. Her book, Transcending Blackness, From the New Millennium Mulatta to the Exceptional Multiracial. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's Weekday.
What do you eat when you're stranded in the Antarctic? Pretty much whatever you can find, right? We'll hear some stories of Antarctic cuisine in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Laird Norton Wealth Management, celebrating 75 years of King County Parks by establishing the King County Parks Foundation, devoted to strengthening families and connecting communities for generations to come. Information on contributing at loveourparks.org.
A couple adopts a child. The birth father takes his daughter back.
It was by far the worst day of our lives, and I'm sure of hers.
She cried after us.
Not a typical case for the U.S. Supreme Court, but it is covered by federal law because the father has Native American ancestry. I'm David Greene, Adopted Children and Tribal Rights, on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow on KUOW's Morning News Magazine, which airs from 4 to 9 a.m.
Support for KUOW comes from the graduate programs at Chapman University, located in Orange County, California, offering master's or doctoral programs in six different colleges. Accreditation and graduate admission information at chapman.edu/graduate degree.
Mostly cloudy and 46 degrees in Seattle. Forecast calls for partly sunny skies this afternoon and a high of 56. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:47. The FAA has ordered special inspections of Boeing 737s. We'll have more on that in 15 minutes.
And now, what is there to eat in the Antarctic? You could try penguin. Roast penguins, scurvy day, and other stories of Antarctic cuisine is Jason C. Anthony's series of essays. His book, he's written in Orion, the Missouri Review, the best American travel writing. He's also spent a lot of time in Antarctica. His book is titled Hoosh. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for bringing me on, Steve.
Speaking tonight at the University Bookstore at 7. What is hoosh?
Hoosh is an old British polar explorer's slang term for the stew they would make on the trail. Basically, it was pemmican, blocks of pemmican melted in melted
and
snow.
And pemmican is?
Right. Before I get to pemmican, they would also mix some crushed biscuit into it to thicken it up a little bit. So it's kind of a goop, you know, or a stew or a soup. And pemmican is the old Native American sort of endurance food, really an incredible sort of ancestor to the Cliff Bar, you might say.
Yeah.
It's dried lean meat ground down and mixed with an equal amount of fat, and then make these blocks of dry protein and fat, maybe a few berries to give it some nutritional, and it could, you know, it has packs a ton of calories in a small space, and you can go forever with it.
Of course, that's what they were hoping to be eating when they traveled to the Antarctic. But sometimes they had to supplement that with what was around. So who was eating roast penguin?
Yeah, well, these early expeditions in the heroic age of Antarctic exploration, they They would bring, you know, sort of usual supplies, things they ate back at home, you know, their corn, their flour and some dried vegetables and that sort of thing. And they would eat those, they would have a cook and that would be fairly regular food, at the hut. But once they went on the trail, they basically just carried pemmican. And, in both cases, either at the hut or on the trail, they would supplement, sometimes out of desperation because they ran out of food, or because, you know, a lot of their food disappeared down a crevasse along with one of their friends and half their dogs. You know, or they would add at the hut, they would add the meat of penguins, especially seals, like a 1,000-pound Weddell seal feeds a lot of men. And it's once you scrape the sort of fishy fat off of it, it apparently tastes quite good. I wouldn't know because unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess, for them, all these creatures were protected by the Antarctic Treaty by the time I arrived in the Antarctic in the early 90s.
A lot of these folks and these early explorers planned on having their food hauling them and walking with them, right? So these guys were planning that sometimes dogs or ponies would be part of their meal as they tried to make their way to the South Pole or whatever they were trying to get to.
Yeah, absolutely, especially on their attempts on the South Pole. The Brits favored ponies for their transport, which was, as it turned out, not a great decision. Ernest Shackleton pioneered that idea, and Robert Falcon Scott tried it again several years later. They also used dogs, but the Brits weren't particularly adept at using dogs, whereas the Norwegians, particularly the expedition leader Roald Amundsen, who was the first man to the South Pole, was expert at using dogs. He had spent years in the Arctic, trained with the Inuit, and knew what he was doing. But yes, Amundsen in particular, he calculated down to the last detail. Not just the pulling power of a dog, but its food value as well.
And when one would tip to the other, and then he would eat the dog.
Yeah, or he'd feed it. More often than not, he fed the dog to other dogs. So therefore, he had to bring less dog food. He liked his dogs, you know, as living things. I think, you know, he didn't mind the food as well. But he was a really very good at what he did, and he was very goal-oriented. And if you want to get to the South Pole, you have to make hard decisions. That was his rationale. Whereas, you know, the Brits brought ponies. They ended up feeding the ponies to the few dogs they had, or they ate the ponies themselves. But ponies can't eat other ponies, so it wasn't the most efficient way of travel. It's not a pleasant thing to talk about, but in terms of efficiency, which was necessary.
All right, fair enough. We won't talk about ponies eating ponies then.
Yeah.
Who were some of the better cooks that showed up in these expeditions?
Again, in the back in the heroic age, you had sort of what I think of as two groups of well, I guess there were three groups of cooks in a sense. You had the sort of do anything can do guy who, you know, had experience cooking in extreme circumstance, you know, on board a vessel or in the Arctic, like Adolf Lindstrom, Roald Amundsen's cook. Very, very good at his job, and you know, on the side he would invent things, build things around the hut. You know, and very useful as an all-around character. And then you had somebody like Rozo, who was the cook for the first French expedition in 1902, who was a real charismatic, idiosyncratic, mysterious character. They picked him up at the last minute in Buenos Aires as they were traveling south. They never learned, you know, despite spending a year with him on their vessel frozen into the harbor at Booth Island, they never learned his real name. They never learned any more about him except that he traveled the world, and he was a great cook.
Well, what were some of the favorite recipes that Rozo produced for the other people in the expedition? I mean, you quote people
absolutely
about
absolutely.
His food.
Yeah, Jean-Baptiste Charcot, the expedition leader, said that he was a remarkable cook. One of his favorites of Rozo's creations was a black pudding made with seal's blood and liver, I believe. And but also, Rozo was an excellent baker, and he was making croissants all through the winter. You know, as he one of the other interesting things about Rozo was that he liked to go barefoot. Or he never wore socks, even in the Antarctic. He would not barefoot, I should say, but without socks, and he would pad his way up and down the hallways of the ship and provide perfect food for these guys.
Who was cooking penguin?
Well, you know, all these early expeditions did to some extent or another. They would count on it because they couldn't bring enough food, really, on the ship to last for a year or two in the Antarctic.
And the penguins were just all around, milling about.
Penguins are typically quite available near a lot of their bases. But really, seals were the... the more common fodder. For one thing, it's a lot easier to get, to gather 1,000 pounds of meat from one animal than to chase down, as they often had to chase down penguins, say like 9 pounds at a time of penguin breast meat.
A lot of this story is about people who live in hard conditions under overturned rowboats and oil cloth for months and months at a time, cooking with little tiny stoves with black soot coming about them.
Yeah.
What's the appeal?
What was the appeal for them?
and then for you.
Yeah. For them, it was a chance to go beyond the normal scope of their lives, to go. A lot of them had, were Navy guys, if we're talking about the Brits. They knew they were already hard men. They lived hard lives. But here was a chance to follow some charismatic leader and do something unusual. Even today, people that sort of self-select to go work in the Antarctic, they tend to be fairly interesting people. It is idiosyncratic and sometimes kind of hard. But really, it's my own experiences. I was down in the Antarctic for 8 years, and you're surrounded by people that with whom you can have just amazing conversations day after day after day.
So. And sometimes you have to. What happened with your? What was your assignment? Maintaining a second airfield.
Yeah, that was. If I had to pick a favorite season on the ice, that was back in 2000 or so, and I spent 3 months with one other fellow, a man named Julian Ridley, and who himself was a great grandson of one of those early heroic age explorers. And we were up in the Transantarctic Mountains on what's called a blue ice glacier, a glacier that's got so much wind sweeping across it that the snow doesn't stick. And our job was to maintain an emergency runway for McMurdo Station, which is the main U.S. base in Antarctica. It has about 1,000 people in it. But here we were, just the two of us, up at about 5,500 feet, living in tents. We built a runway on this hard ice, and waited for planes to come, which they never did. So we spent much of our summer exploring the peaks of the Transantarctic Mountains and had a really, really wonderful time.
How important was the food then?
The quantity for both Julian and I, we're both sort of tall and skinny, and it's all about quantity as much as anything. And we usually started with dessert, and then just kept making more food.
Why'd you start with dessert?
Oh, it was what we preferred, I guess. We had a lot of Cadbury chocolate, and we made good use of it. Obviously we had to plan ahead. I was asked to plan the trip as a 3 month journey, and to bring all of our food, every meal, every snack for that time period.
What did you get tired of after the second month that you brought?
Actually, we were pretty happy with what we had. We get supplements, as it turned out. We were told initially that we might not get a resupply flight for the entire summer. But as it turned out, we had helicopters and planes coming and going all the time, little planes. They brought us odds and ends, even fresh fruit and vegetables.
So besides the Cadbury bars and you had fruit and vegetables, what was your staple for meal?
It was typical sort of bachelor cuisine. We had frozen bagels and frozen burgers and frozen this and frozen that.
So could you imagine yourself living the way some of Shackleton's men had to live on that island? For how long were they on that island, those guys? After Shackleton sailed away,
the Endurance expedition. Yeah, Elephant. They were there for 5 months, or 4.5 months, living under their overturned boats, as you were saying earlier. And their hoosh was composed not of pemmican, but of limpets they scraped off the rocks, and maybe they'd experiment with seaweed, and then the occasional penguin or seal, and that sort of thing. Living in those huts and underneath those boats, covered in soot. It's hard not to want to be there after spending years, thinking about it and writing about it. But they're all lucky. They were all lucky to be alive. That whole group should have died several times. So you have to be careful what you wish for, I guess.
Jason C. Anthony's book is Hoosh, Roast Penguin, Scurvy Day, and Other Stories of Antarctic Cuisine. He's speaking tonight at the University Bookstore in Seattle. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Steve.
It was a weekday.
And now, the sound of the day.
No, that's not penguins. That's chickens. Listener Ellen recorded the chatter of her neighbor's chickens after they encountered a raccoon. That is the sound of some very disturbed chickens. Just imagine if there was somebody wandering around a penguin pen trying to grab them. So what are you hearing? Record 30 seconds of the sounds of your day and send it to us, along with the story behind it. Email it to weekday@kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. Dow Constantine will be joining us, and we'll talk about patenting genes. It's all coming up.
Insurgents in Iraq deployed a series of coordinated attacks across Iraq today with dozens of people killed. This is less than a week before elections. Our full report in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from CareSimple, providing 24/7 medical care by phone and webcam at home, at work, or on the go. For many conditions, including the flu, CareSimple can diagnose, treat, and if appropriate, prescribe medications. Online at caresimple.com.
Remember China's one-child policy? Seemed like a good idea. Now China's birth rate is low and the government...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.